From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in New Mexico in the 1980s. Luis Quiñones started out his teaching career in high school, and at the time, assimilation was the goal of education for students of Mexican descent. And there were many. Quiñones found that the curriculum focused mainly on the achievements of white men in America, the great white men of the American story. But Quiñones found that this focus alienated some of the Chicano students, the Mexican Americans who felt left out of the story. He had a different idea. He focused on ways to value and teach Chicano students about their own heritage and culture in bilingual, bicultural settings. More than three decades later, Dr. Quiñones is a retired educator and continuing the work of bringing more balance and justice to education. What should it look like in classrooms today? What approach would he bring to Rochester, where the demographics are perhaps much different than they are in New Mexico? Does bicultural, bilingual education work? Dr. Quiñones is a guest of the Rochester Committee on Latin America tonight for an event here in our city. But first, he's our guest in the studio on Connections. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Evan.
And later this hour, I should let our listeners know, you're going to play a little guitar.
I'm going to try to play a couple of songs if there's time.
There will be time. If anybody who brings a guitar, we make the time. Arnold Matland is the secretary for RACLA. Welcome. Thanks for being here, Arnold.
It's a pleasure to be back, Evan.
And as always, we want to let you know about the event if you want to attend, listeners. And if you've seen information on it, make sure that you note that it is at 7 o'clock tonight. It's a conversation, a plática with Dr. Luis Quiñones, the Chicano Justice Movement and Beyond, from 7 to 9. And this is at Abundance, Arnold, is that right?
Abundance Co-op.
It's on South Avenue.
571 South Avenue, yeah. That's a change, and it's wrong in city newspaper. So it's a problem for us, but...
Hold on, we have a partnership with City, and they're never wrong.
Oh, okay. Well, if they show up where City says to show up, they're not going to see Dr. Quiñones.
It's at Abundance tonight, yes.
Yeah, Abundance Co-op, and we apologize to the public for that glitch. But so everybody knows, 571 South Avenue, 7 p.m.
And Arnold, briefly, before we dig in with Luis here, tell me why you were eager to have Dr. Quiñones come to Rochester.
Well, to be honest, he's a personal friend. Secondly, the Chicano-Chicana struggle is something that we don't hear much about, but it's very, very real. And I'm not an expert. He's the expert, and I'm not going to take the public's time. But the fact is that we don't think about this. And unless you happen to have Spanish as your first language, you probably don't think of it either. But people should be thinking of it, and that's why I'm so pleased all the way from Albuquerque to come to the program.
Well, Dr. Quiñones, take me back to, you know, your time teaching, especially, set the scene for me. It's the 1980s. You're teaching high school in New Mexico. What were the demographics of the classroom, and what was the expectation with assimilation?
Well, things have not changed a whole lot. People are still expected to learn English and to learn the white history, the white literature, etc. So after a couple of years of teaching, I was noticing that I was not reaching the students in the way that I wanted. And so I introduced a class called Chicano Studies in Literature, since I was an English teacher. And then with that, we also had classes in bilingual poetry to try to promote more critical thinking and writing. But the whole idea of the Chicano Studies in Literature is to expose the students to other role models, other heroes, other people's histories, since it was kind of whitewashed with the George Washingtons and Jeffersons. And we have so many individuals and organizations that made an impact in the Chicano experience and for the United States, including, the Chicanos, of course, the African-Americans, Puerto Ricanos, white working class individuals who are heroes who helped us promote inclusion and democracy in the workplace.
What was the reaction of white students, white families, white administrators to your desire to move education in this direction?
Okay, our high school was 80% Chicano at that time, and I was teaching at the same school that I went to school with, and I swore I would never become a teacher, but that's what happened after some years in another career. But the reaction was, I had some counselors that were very supportive, and the principal was supportive, but of course you always wait for the community reaction, and the students were my I guess the best supporters, the ones that would go out to say, you know, they enjoyed the class and they never
the
missed class.
The white students?
Well, the white students were also in the classes too. So we, and they, and of course you
try. But you didn't have complaints. You didn't have complaints from parents, from...
Not about the curriculum. Isn't that amazing? Because we try to make it inclusive. And, of course, a lot of cooperative learning where all the students all participate. And all of them are leaders. All of them are participants. All of them are followers, if you will. But believe it or not, there were very few. Let me see. There was one individual thought that was wondering if we were being patriotic or not. And it was a Chicano student, a Chicana. Student.
Isn't that interesting?
Of course. Well, you know, of course, we all come with different perspectives and different opinions. So I expected that. I thought there would be more of a resistance. And one of the first things I did in class, I showed the movie The Salt of the Earth, which was filmed right there in that community back then. And it was kind of a big secret, The Salt of the Earth. And I was in college when I first learned about it. And it was filmed right there with local actors. The Salt of the Earth is a film about a strike that occurred there where the women, after the men were prohibited from picketing, the women took over the picket lines. And so it made international news. Some Hollywood filmmakers came to the area and they made a film. One of the most famous films in the history of film. Oh, by the way, the most watched film in history. Nope, not too many people know that. And the reason is because Chairman Mao made it mandatory in China.
Oh, wow. Well, and so as we kind of explore your goal for the classroom, your goal for real justice in an approach educational settings, tell me what the risk is. If you hadn't tried to move education in a different direction, away from, as you say, a predominantly white and exclusionary form of education, what's the risk to the students?
There is no risk to the students. I think the students...
If it had stayed the same, Luis, if it had stayed, if you had not made the change...
Oh, I see.
What's the damage or the risk to students doing it the way that it had been done?
Well, when the curriculum is ethnocentric and it's centrist, as you say, people are not exposed to the values of other human beings because this country was built through the labor and the intelligence of many individuals from multiracial backgrounds and economic backgrounds and immigrants and et cetera. And of course, our the Native American experience is so important also in any Chicano studies class, because essentially it's an ethnic studies class where you learn about all the achievements of working class people primarily, as opposed to the elites who are the ones who usually write the history. And those are the ones that are included in United States history books to this day.
Yeah. I know that Mexico is going to be undertaking its own census coming up here, and in the coming weeks we're going to be sitting down with Pablo Sierra, who is a professor at the University of Rochester, who's written a book, and we're going to be talking about demographic change. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of talk in this country about multiculturalism, some resistance or fear of multiculturalism, or a fear, frankly, among some segments of the white population of losing white identity or losing sort of white majorities. And as Dr. Sierra points out in his writing, this is, the United States is not the only place where this struggle with multiculturalism is happening. So when you talk about Chicano education, when you talk about what it means to be Mexican American, Mexico has a lot of diversity. Mexico has diverse populations.
Yes.
How do you approach what it means to be Chicano? And to understand sort of the texture of experience there.
Okay. Well, let's look a little bit at the term Chicano. It comes from the word Mexicano. But in the United States, the word Chicano takes on another element, and that element is one of resistance, of knowledge and awareness of your roots, of your connection with your Native American heritage from Mexico or from the United States. And so that's the element of Chicano. As far as multiculturalism, the United States has always been multicultural. Just some people have refused and continue to refuse that it is multicultural. It was multicultural before the Europeans invaded, and it was multicultural after the Europeans invaded. So we're just promoting the beauty of diversity, So all of us have something to contribute. And it's amazing, the more you talk to people, how much we have in common. We have a lot more in common than we have different. And people, I don't know why people are afraid of change, because it's all around us, and it has always been around us, and it has enriched our country and the world.
Talking to Dr. Luis Quiñones, did you spend your entire teaching career in New Mexico?
I did.
In New Mexico, and still live in New Mexico.
I still live in New Mexico.
Visiting Rochester as a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America. So some numbers here. About 61% of Mexican Americans live in just two states, California and Texas, according to the 2010 census. The distribution of Mexican Americans in the United States by region is about 52% living in the American West, 35% in the South, 11% in the Midwest, only about 3% in the Northeast. But here in the Northeast, we have got a very vibrant community of Puerto Ricanos who live here, mm-hmm. Some only moving here recently after mm-hmm. natural disasters. So your desire to see equitable education, what does it look like in Rochester with a different sort of demographic population than it would look like in Albuquerque?
Okay, I see that. I think there's a value in bilingual or multilingual education for everybody, with the dominant culture, the non-dominant culture, for the people that come to the United States with their heritage language, let's say their heritage language is Spanish, and they're learning English, all the studies indicate that through the process of good bilingual education, that they're able to learn the second language in a better way. And that benefits society. That benefits the United States. For the English-only speaking population, they are exposed to a second language, and that's going to promote cross-cultural appreciation, cross-cultural associations, and it's going to benefit them. In the classroom, in the elementary classroom, where you introduce bilingual education, and a lot of times it's immersion, dual language education, you see all the students benefit. The monolingual English students in the studies that we have studied, the monolingual students are achieving 1 year's progress every single year. With a bilingual immersion dual language individuals, they surpass the monolingual English around the 6th, 7th grade, believe it or not, through the achievement test. That's what the studies indicate.
But teaching bilingual English and Spanish,
yes,
should happen in all classrooms?
Well, if the language of the area is, if the second language is Spanish, I would say so, yes, of course. But there are other languages too, and I think, our country is so bent on one language that they forget that higher achievement is benefited when there's more languages involved. If you're a great achiever in one language, can you imagine two languages?
Well, and what about going in the other direction for those who now live in Rochester who've come from Puerto Rico, for those who live in Albuquerque who are either of Mexican heritage or come directly recently from Mexico and mm-hmm. speak Spanish but not English, mm-hmm. do you find value in the call for all students in this country to learn English?
Well, I do. Because the people that enroll their children in dual language immersion, the first ones are your college professors, the business people, because they understand that knowing two languages is going to benefit them. And the parents sometimes are not sure. They want to speak English, thinking, well, they already know Spanish, but there's more to language than just speaking it. There's reading, there's writing, and then, of course, the fluency that comes through that, the literacy.
Let's talk a little bit about how we've seen things change when it comes to dropout rates, when it comes mm-hmm. to educational outcomes. So Pew has some encouraging and some perhaps discouraging news. Let me go ahead and read from a number of sources, and then I'll get your take, Dr. Quiñones.
Okay.
First of all, this is from The Crisis in the Education of Latino Students, an article written by Patricia Gandara from the Civil Rights Project, the Proyecto Derechos Civiles, from the University of California, Los Angeles. And this was written about 15 years ago. I'm going to quote, and then we're going to update the numbers. This is what she wrote in 2005. Quote, "The most urgent problem for the American education system has a Latino face. Latinos are the largest, most rapidly growing ethnic minority in the country, but academically they are lagging dangerously far behind their non-Hispanic peers. For example, upon entering kindergarten, 42% of Latino children are found in the lowest quartile of performance on reading readiness compared to just 18% of white children. By fourth grade, 16% of Latino students are proficient in reading, according to the 2005 NAEP, compared to 41% of white students. A similar pattern is notable in the eighth grade, where only 15% of Latinos are proficient in reading compared to 39% of whites. With respect to college completion, only 11% of Latinos 25 to 29 years of age had a BA or higher compared to 34% of whites. Perhaps most distressing is the fact that no progress has been made in the percentage of Latinos gaining college degrees over a 20-year period, while other groups have seen significant increases in degree completion. That was in 2005. Mm-hmm. Here's what Pew finds out about 11 years later. The Hispanic dropout rate hits a new low, college enrollment at a new high. The Hispanic dropout rate was 10% in 2016, with about 648,000 Hispanics ages 18 to 24 out of more than 6.5 million nationally in that age group not completing high school and not enrolled in school. Since 1999, the earliest year for which data of all major races and ethnicities are available, the dropout rate among Hispanics has fallen by 24 percentage points, compared with 9 points among black students, 3 points among whites, 2 points among Asians. Hispanics, however, still have the highest dropout rate of these four groups. So we're looking at numbers that show a changing picture, that more Hispanic students, generally speaking, are graduating high school, more are going to college, more are completing college, though the numbers are still the most distressing out of all demographic groups. How do you see the picture today compared to when you were teaching in the 1980s, compared to what was written in 2005, and now? How do you see it changing?
I see it very, very similar. I think we have opportunities to address what's going on. The first thing is admitting that we have a problem, and the problem is not the students. The problem is the system. The problem is the educational system and their inability or their reluctance to address the issues through the students, or what the students' gifts are. One of the problems is that the curriculum does not value second languages, does not value second language learners. It does not value multiculturalism. The student needs to see herself and himself in the curriculum. And you know, there will be those students that will achieve no matter what. But one of the best ways to reach our students, all students, African-American students, white working class students, they need to see themselves in the curriculum. If they don't see themselves in the curriculum, there's less propensity for success. They feel left out. Let me give you a short poem that I remember reading back in the 80s to my students. I read it first in college, and it's called George Washington's My Father. So this is the way it goes. I'm in my history class. The professor commences rapping. I'm in my history class, and I'm on the verge of napping. Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Tell me more. Tell me more. 13 colonies were founded. Oh, I've heard that all before. What's that he said? Dare I bother? But it sounded like he said, George Washington's my father. I'm reluctant to believe it. I suddenly raised my mano. If George Washington's my father, why wasn't he Chicano? So, you know, that's just a short indication. We need to show all the benefits, the role models, the histories of the different multiracial groups that exist in the United States from the very beginning. With our Native Americans, Puerto Ricanos, women are left out quite a bit. It's hard to find in the history books the heroes. They have been incredible organizers, some of the best. Emma Tenayuca in San Antonio. Of course, we know about Dolores Huerta with the United Farm Workers of America, Luisa Moreno. We really need to start making our curriculum multi-ethnic and celebrate the working class heroes of our country. And I think you'll reach more students that way than just teaching a white curriculum.
Now, taking that mantra, mm-hmm. in the 1980s when you were teaching, a little bit different than it is today, I think, and I could be wrong, and I'm happy to be educated about this, when it comes to standardized testing. We hear from a lot of teachers a couple of things. Number one, the standardized testing regime is so strict, there are so many strictures, that there's not a whole lot of room for creativity, that there are certain things you have to get done on a yearly basis. And number two, they don't write the textbooks. And those who write the textbooks have a lot of power in this country. Are those things wrong?
Well, yes, because it's not inclusive. And, you know, when you say I taught in the 1980s, well, I thought through the 90s and into the 2000s also. So I've been out of education for about whatever that means. But I've been retired for about 7 years through the public schools. As far as the testing goes, I remember it was Andy Kaufman who said the standardized test will show you how big the house is where the student lives. In other words, it's an economic factor is one of the things. Okay, that being said, we need to be more inclusive, include the teachers in the testing. The No Child Left Behind Act that was enacted by George Bush, we used to call it the No Corporation Left Behind because the corporations were jumping in line to make a lot of money through making these standardized tests. And again, that being said, Let's address that. If standardized tests is going to be the norm for measuring achievement, okay, well, let's address it. Let's make a good test that will show us how well the students are doing on an annual basis.
But do you agree with the fact or the idea that teachers don't have a whole lot of room to go in different directions, that there's so much when it comes to standardized testing that they're sort of handcuffed?
This is the beauty of it. If you promote critical thinking exercises where the students think outside the box, not the what or the where that they're learning, but how and the whys, I think you'll get more success in this. To address your question, that there's no room, our teachers need to get creative in the classroom. It's easy to say, and they're being viewed through a microscope. So a lot of them feel that they're handicapped. They just teach to the test. And we still had tests when I was teaching, when I was an administrator. So we have to get creative to beat the system, if you will. Otherwise, it's gonna swallow you up, and you're going to promote students that are good test takers, but they're not going to be able to think outside of that test-taking mode.
And what about textbooks? Because we see almost annual controversies about various pieces of history described in American textbooks. Mm-hmm. I can think of an example from Texas where enslaved people were described as laborers, just workers, when they were enslaved people from Africa. Mm-hmm. When the textbooks use these kinds of euphemisms, that certainly can have an impact. And I'm wondering if you think that we need a whole rewrite of textbooks.
Well, of course. And it has to be inclusive. I remember being in fifth grade and the teacher describing the Battle of El Alamo. Remember the Alamo? But I remember the teacher describing that and talking about these savage, cruel Mexican forces fighting these freedom-fighting Texans that were in the Alamo. And then you start reading between the lines later on, and you find out that it was a myth. The ones that were in El Alamo were slave owners. They did not like that Mexico had enacted a constitution in 1824 that prohibited slavery. And Mexico wanted and required them not to have any slaves. So that was one of the reasons for being in El Alamo. Of course, there's other reasons, including that there was a centralized government in Mexico City, etc. But essentially, these were slave owners, slave smugglers, and people that abused and cruelly treated their slaves. So they were freed. From the Alamo, there was one person that was allowed, well, there were actually two that were allowed to go free before the battle started, and there was an African slave and an older woman. And so anyway, all these stories need to be described through critical thinking. Okay, let's present that, but the teacher is responsible in the classroom to say, okay, let's look at another perspective and let's have some discussions about this. And let's find out, what is your truth? What is your truth about the Alamo? Is this the truth that the textbook is describing? Is that what you think the Alamo happened? Or were there other stories? And I wish that they would look at all history in that sense.
Who's in charge, though?
Who's in charge? The teacher.
Well,
no, huh?
I guess here's what I mean by that. What you're proposing is a significant reworking of curriculum, of how history is taught, of
literature.
I was going to say, you were an English teacher, right?
Yes.
So in this community, a few years ago, we did a year-long study of the makeup of diversity or not in public school teaching staffs. Mm-hmm. And then part of that story was the resulting choice of what's on the reading list. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of great books on the reading list, but almost all of them were white authors, white protagonists. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure you're used to that. If we were to see a nationwide change to really diversify reading lists in high school classrooms and in English textbooks, if we were to talk about history in a different way, if we were to bring more of a diverse approach to the heroic model of history, not just, as you have said, sort of the heroic white men, I'm wondering what the mechanism is to actually change that. Who's in charge of changing that, and what kind of movement is required to convince people? Because right now, Betsy DeVos probably ain't interested in that. And there's a lot of people who are probably not interested in that.
Right. Right. No, she's not going to help. She's going to make things worse. And she has. We need people to rise up in their local school boards, and there's a power structure in place. But the ultimate power is in the people. Excuse me. But we will have to organize. It takes organizing to do this. When I said who's in charge in the classroom, and I say the teacher, there's a lot of pressure on the teacher. And of course, one of them is their employment, that there's a principal or other authority that goes and evaluates them, and somehow is the one that critiques what they do or don't do. We're going to have to demand, like any change in the United States that has ever occurred, or through demands, when people rise up and say, we need to be more inclusive. And so your Puerto Ricano families, Chicano families, Salvadoreño families, African-American families, we're going to have to rise up, and white working class families are going to have to rise up and say, enough is enough. We need an education that is inclusive. One of the biggest gaps in the United States curriculum right now, they don't talk about working class issues. They don't talk about the unions that finally started bringing democracy to the workplace and democracy to the United States. These unions are left out. Organizing is left out of the curriculums. None of those individuals who were involved with organizing efforts are mentioned, very seldom.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because the corporations are the ones that are very involved with education. They're the ones involved with writing the textbooks, and so they have a lot of power in what goes into those textbooks, unfortunately. And so a lot of teachers, they go to university, they might not know about all the unionizing efforts that help to make this country a little bit more democratic. They don't know about the working class people. They don't know about the brown and black and white and Asian individuals that help make this country great. Because the college curriculums are very conservative also, from what I found, except for
very narrow,
except for a few classes. Yes.
So who should be writing the textbooks?
The people, the generals and the presidents and the senators and the CEOs should never be writing our history books.
Why is that?
Because they're going to promote the perspective of the rich, of the oligarchs. And so right now, our textbooks are represent oligarchic history. So this is a country of the people, supposedly, for the people, et cetera. But the people were content with electing officials to the county, to the state, to national. But there's so much money involved that right now, as Will Rogers said, we have the best democracy money can buy. And our curriculums have been bought off by the elites, in my opinion.
Secretary of Education is, I don't know if she's a billionaire, a mega millionaire. The president is maybe a billionaire if we saw his tax returns. Some of the leading contenders throughout this presidential cycle on the Democratic side, there were three. Howard Schultz was the first billionaire. Tom Steyer, mm-hmm. Michael Bloomberg. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably missing another, all billionaires in this race. Money is a big, big factor in American politics. And it's not just on the sort of political right, though. So I think that you've got a really big challenge in changing these things. If you see this problem, Dr. Quinones, I don't know how you I'm not saying it can't be done, but but it's not a right-left paradigm. It's more of sort of a top-down paradigm, I would see it.
Yeah, I don't think that we have a voice. We believe that, okay, let's say Republicans are right-wing. We have Democrats who are being described as moderate, but we don't have a voice, a significant voice on the left. People think that the Democratic Party is on the left, and I find that a lot of times they're very close to Republican values. So the people need to make both parties responsible to the people. Okay, we have working class people voting Republican against their own interests. Not to say that the Democratic Party, I didn't want to get into a
political thing. No, I hear you.
But when we say the Democratic Party represents the left, we're in trouble because right now there is no party that represents the left, in my opinion.
We wanted to take a break from politics. We're saving Super Tuesday for tomorrow on Connections. Dr. Luis Quinones is our guest here, and his presentation tonight, A Conversation, the Chicano Justice Movement and Beyond. It's from 7 to 9 at Abundance Food Co-op on South Avenue. 7 to 9 at Abundance. Tonight he's a guest of ROCLA, the Rochester Committee on Latin America. Briefly, Dr. Quinones, what do you plan to talk about this evening at 7 o'clock?
Well, today I was invited to talk about the Chicano experience and Chicana experience. So that is one of the things that I will be talking about, and also about working class experiences.
And in our second half hour, va a tocar la guitarra. So we're going to hear a little bit of music from Dr. Quinones before the hour is up. When we come back, we're going to kind of explore some of the other themes here that I think are animating this debate about where education in this country goes next. We're right back with him on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, Bill Carpenter, CEO of RTS, joins us. We're talking about the future of transit in Rochester and the region. What have we learned from a couple of years of planning and study? And what does the future of RTS look like? He'll tell us in our second hour. What have we learned from Super Tuesday? And what do supporters of campaigns locally think should happen next? Talk with you on Thursday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Dr. Luis Quinones was a teacher for several decades and now retired, but doing activism and education and work around the country. And he's in Rochester as a guest of the Rochester Committee on Latin America. Is the guitar in tune? We'll do it right before the end of the hour. Is it in tune?
It's in tune, as far as I know. I'm from the Close Enough School of Tuning.
I like that. I grew up in the Close Enough School of Tuning. That's the best kind of school. So whenever education on sort of bicultural, bilingual education comes up, I think there might be some conflation of ideas about what we're actually talking about here. I want to go back into a little bit of history and get your take on where this country has been historically, and then we'll talk about where we are now. This is what The Atlantic wrote about bilingual education back in 1998 as they tried to assess whether legislation had been successful. But again, I think it was the intentions were different. So this is from The Atlantic in 1998. Quote, in the mid-1960s, when the civil rights movement for African Americans was at its height and Latino activists began to protest the damaging circumstances that led to unacceptably high proportions of school dropouts among Spanish-speaking children, more than 50% nationwide, Latino leaders borrowed the strategies of the civil rights movement, calling for legislation to address the needs of Spanish-speaking children, Cubans in Florida, Mexicans along the southern border, Puerto Ricans in the Northeast. In 1968, Congress approved a bill filed by Senator Ralph Yarborough of Texas, aimed at removing the language barrier to an equal education. The Bilingual Education Act was a modestly funded amendment to the Elementary and Secondary Education Act of 1965, intended to help poor Mexican-American children learn English. At the time, the goal was not to keep any specific language alive, Yarborough said. It is not the purpose of this bill, he said, to create pockets of different languages throughout the country, but just to try to make those children fully literate in English. End quote. In simplest terms, bilingual education is a special effort to help immigrant children learn English so that they can do regular schoolwork with their English-speaking classmates and receive an equal educational opportunity. But what it is in the letter and spirit of the law is not what it has become in practice. Some experts decided early on that children should be taught for a time in their native languages so that they would continue to learn other subjects while learning English. It was expected that the transition would take a child 3 years. From this untried experimental idea grew an education industry that expanded far beyond its original mission to teach English and resulted in the extended segregation of non-English-speaking students, end quote.
Oh, my goodness.
Is that an accurate view of history?
I would hope not, but it's not. There's different models for bilingual education. Now, I am one of those that believe in cultural preservation. If I come to the table, here are my gifts. I speak Spanish or another native language or Navajo or Apache or Japanese. I'm bringing some gifts into this classroom that should be recognized. And then not only that, but I am accepting new gifts by learning English. And that's what it should be. It should be inclusive and it should be additive as opposed to subtractive. When you subtract, when you take away somebody's culture or try to do that, you're hurting the child. You're hurting education. If you want to promote literacy in English, the best way to do it is through dual language. Now, there were some models where, we'll have a little bit of a Spanish, an hour of Spanish a day, and the other 5-6 hours in English, etc., to try to get the child acclimated. I applied those efforts, and those are positive. But the best model for, and it's under the Bilingual Education Act, is dual language immersion. And both children benefit, both dominant English children and second language learners benefit from that. It's the best model for promoting literacy in English, to be quite honest. It also promotes literacy in the native language, so everybody wins.
Yeah, I can't help but feel like when I read what The Atlantic wrote in 1998 that there is a disinterest or a lack of concern about cultural erasure. And I don't use that term sort of blithely. I take that very seriously, but it seems that what The Atlantic is saying as they assess the Bilingual Education Act is well, look, if you try to preserve the culture of Chicano students or the culture of Puerto Rican students, ultimately, what you just do is they end up segregating themselves, or the teacher will segregate them. It doesn't work. You can't do it. You can't do both at the same time, which to me seems to be putting a dominance on English and one kind of experience at the expense of others, and sort of giving up. Do you view it that way? I mean, does it sound like that they're unconcerned about erasure there?
It looks like they want erasure. And that never has worked. It never worked when the Native Americans were put in schools, taken away from the reservations or from the families. Kind of what we have right now, family separations. But here they took the Native Americans and placed them in English-only schools where they would try to erase their culture and their language and all their experiences. And it was a terrible, terrible experiment. It was a crime.
What would you say if there are teachers or parents or families who claim that, well, even in the best intentions, there ends up being sort of a de facto segregation in schools among cultures if you do this, so best to just focus education more homogeneously?
See, education and language acquisition is not about opinions. It's not about, oh, this is what I believe and this is what I believe. There's research or scientific methods that have been applied to it, and the best learning environment for all involved, especially for your second language learners, is bilingual education through a dual language. Everybody wins. And again, it's like another topic, climate change. Well, what's your opinion? Well, it's not about opinion. It's about science. Let's look at the science first. And in language acquisition, in education, there are many, many scientific models that we must respect. Or go do your own research and prove it wrong. That's okay. That's part of the process. But there is science behind learning languages.
Well, let me get Rich from Rochester on the phone, who wants to respond to what he's been hearing. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how are you doing, Evan?
Very good, sir.
Well, to your guest point, I just find this is the old American way of doing things, of what they did to the Native Americans, of trying to wipe out their cultures, their language, their foods, their religion, doing the same thing to people who come here to this country. But people don't understand, with wiping out a language, you lose ways of expression, you lose ways of thinking, you lose food, you lose so much that goes with that language. And I don't understand why people can't celebrate someone and accept someone else's culture. And part of that is to be that inclusive person. And it always frustrates me to watch these things with, you know, go back to where you came from. You're in the U.S., you talk English here, even though half of the people don't even know what English is. And it's just, it's frustrating to watch these type of attitudes, and I so agree with your guest.
Yeah, Rich, I mean, to your point there, I mean, it's sad, but we could probably just play videos all day that have gone viral in recent years since the advent of cell phone video of people in grocery stores. I mean, the two women in Colorado who were yelling at the woman speaking Spanish, you know, speak English, you know, you live in America now. And frankly, some of the reasons they go viral is the cruelty, but also it's nice to see people step in public also and kind of clap back a little bit. But it happens. This is happening all over the place. So, Rich, what do we do about that? Before I turn it over to Dr. Quinones, what do you think we ought to do about that, Rich?
We have to learn to celebrate and embrace others. I remember I went on a trip to one of the national parks on the northeast coast of Canada, and I went to this little town and they had Celtic dancing. But not only did they have Celtic dancing, they had the language. Did I understand it? Did I embrace it in the sense of knowing it and liking it? No, but with that, like I said, came all this stuff. And even within our country, the different dialects, when you go into the Appalachia or you go into South Carolina, as you lose these languages, so much goes with it. And this thing that we call America, that was supposed to be what made it so great, and we're doing it. It seems like we have to figure out a way of being inclusive with people, having them to assimilate, but somehow embracing their cultures and keeping those cultures alive. You know, I just think it's so important.
Rich, thank you. I appreciate that. I'll let Dr. Quinones jump in. Go ahead, Dr. Quinones.
Oh, I love the words that he used about celebrating and embracing, and that's what this is all about. I think once our country becomes that, a country that celebrates and embraces the people that are in there. When you talk about our country, you know, we have anthems, we have pledges, we have our flags and et cetera, but the country is the people. The people, how I treat you is, if I treat you well, I'm being the highest patriot there is, if I treat you well, because our country is us. It's not these I won't go into there, but the country is us, and if we celebrate our people, ourselves, we will be more successful as a nation. We will be more successful in everything we do, whether it's education or sociology or economic. We will be a country that will be inclusive, maybe a model for the rest of the world, because that's not what we are right now.
I want to key in on a word that you kind of observe Rich use, which is celebration. Mm-hmm. We should celebrate differences in cultures and gifts. You've used the term gifts to a classroom when a child speaks a different language than most of the other students. When there's new cultural identities present in a new space, that those should be viewed as gifts. I have to be very, very careful not to get on my soapbox, because I, as a parent of an almost 8-year-old, I just try to observe how kids see the world. And more I find that it's not enough to say, well, I'm not going to display prejudice in front of my child. I'm not going to display bigotry. More and more I find myself thinking, you must overtly tell children that differences are gifts, that they are to be celebrated, that they are cool, that they are interesting, and that they are not to be mocked, that they are not to be feared. Because if you're not overt about that, mm-hmm. somebody else is going to teach them that those differences are something to be mocked, laughed at, shunned, feared. And I know I sound like I'm on a soapbox, but it's so interesting to watch how fast those ideas can take hold in kids if we're not careful.
Exactly.
So Rich's point about celebrating and viewing differences as gifts, I think is important.
Yeah, we have to be aware of everything we do, and especially the tremendous responsibility in the classroom and the words that we use, the behaviors, our Everything goes into modeling for the child. We certainly don't want to demonstrate something negatively. I just unintentionally, I think a lot of times we may do that without realizing it. So it's important to continue to critique ourselves and promote that awareness so that we do not demonstrate anything, any negative reactions toward other people's.
Let me grab another phone call. This is Tom calling in Rochester. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
I want to mention that in Europe, they speak 2, 3, or 4 languages, and they probably learn everybody else's, the different aspects of everybody's
cultures,
lifestyle.
Yeah. Sure. Tom, thank you. He's just pointing out that in Europe,
yes,
in a lot of different communities, there's lots of different languages. It's much more common to sort of see that multicultural approach.
Yes, and it's natural. They don't, I know 4 languages, et cetera. It's very natural to do that. And they've done it because they are able to communicate with, the different cultures. And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful entry into learning about another person. Isn't that one of the highest compliments that you can pay a person, is to try to learn about them? And isn't that wonderful?
Show curiosity about their experience. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let me get one more phone call, and then we're going to get a little music to close the hour. John in Rochester. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Doctor. Doctor, I have to take issue with one thing you said about we're not a model for diversity in the United States. I think we are a model for diversity. We've got people fighting to get into this country. What are your thoughts on that comment?
Well, I like what you said. You're right. We are a diverse nation, and we need to recognize it and celebrate everyone. As far as people coming to our country, a lot of the reasons are economic. Some of it is because of the violence that we have created around the world. So in the 1980s, we had wars in Central America. We continue to have wars around the world that our tax dollars are funding. We create refugees, and then we don't like them. So we need to be cognizant of what we do as a nation to promote that. As far as people wanted to come into the country, I think that's a compliment if they're coming for those correct reasons.
Exactly. Yeah, that's my point.
Uh-huh. So thank you for your comment.
Yep. Thanks, Doctor.
John, thank you very much for the phone call. So we've got a few minutes left here. You brought the guitar. You also have an interesting page open. I just have to note that I'm seeing honor conscientious objectors. Did you open to that page for a reason?
Well, I have a People's Pledge of Allegiance that I was going to read if we had time.
Go ahead. We've got time.
I'm one of those. I'm an anti-war activist.
Okay.
And I wasn't till I was a junior in high school. And I saw the photographs of the My Lai massacre. And before that, I was like everybody else, rah, 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 domino theory, communism, et cetera. When I saw that, I said, oh, this is so cruel. I couldn't believe that people representing our nation would do something like that. I started reading, and it wasn't an isolated incident. I became an anti-war activist. I think war is evil in all its essence. We had a couple of conscientious objectors from my community, and they were so courageous because you know people react to somebody that doesn't want to fight the government's wars. So one of the things that we have, I have a calendar that I publish. Mm-hmm. It's called La Raza Peace and Historical Calendar. So I try to be inclusive about all the wonderful people that we've and heroes in this country. And so I put in every day, I try to put something that occurred for peace or et cetera. So anyway, honor conscientious objectors, because I remember my brother was in college and he was against the Vietnam War, and some of his friends would come back from the Vietnam War and say, Jesus, what are you doing? Do you protest against the Vietnam War? And he would say, yes, I do protest. Well, don't you support us? And he would say, the reason I protest is because I want you to come back home safe, so to be with your families. And he had this gift of gab, and they would say, well, thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Jesus. So the whole thing of being anti-war is to try to suppress, stop unnecessary killing.
So tonight, 7 o'clock at Abundance Co-op on South Avenue, a conversation with Dr. Luis Quinones, who's been our guest for the hour. He's here from New Mexico talking about the Chicano justice movement and beyond. He's a guest of the Rochester Committee on Latin America. If you want to read that, and then we'll close with a little bit of your music, but go ahead with the
there
pledge
we
of
go.
Luis. There you go.
There's a People's Pledge of Allegiance that I wrote, and it says, I pledge allegiance to the earth, to the air, the clouds, the rains and snows, to the streams and rivers and lakes, and seas and oceans, to the soil, the pebbles, the hills and mountains and valleys, to the winds, the animals, the birds, the reptiles, the fish, plants, fruits and vegetables and grasses, to forests, to all trees and flowers, to butterflies and bees and all pollinators, to sunrises and sunsets, to random acts of kindness, to the children and all of the earth's women and men, to our abuelas y abuelos and ancestors, to mental and physical health, to the waterfalls, caverns, and glaciers, to the balance and equilibrium and harmony and poetry and rhythm and music of the earth, to the sun, the stars, the moon, to understanding, love, and friendship, to smiles and giggles and laughter, to peace and all of its elements, and to eternal vigilance, resilience, and perseverance in the ultimate elimination of hatred, racism, sexism, poverty, inequality, militarism, and war.
That's the People's Pledge of Allegiance.
The People's Pledge of Allegiance.
Dr. Quinones. Hey, thanks for being here. And in our last 75 seconds or so, we're going to let your music take us to the end of the hour. This is Dr. Luis Quinones.
I hope I give justice to Woody Guthrie. Jesus Christ was a man who traveled through the land, hardworking man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. But the banksters and the businessmen and the soldiers and the cops laid Jesus Christ in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same, sell all your jewelry and give it to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus came to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on the cross, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave.